Dr. Wild, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
A bit of an ignoramus here. I don't quite...
Right. Okay.
Mine needs writing. Mine follows right on the...
Okay, next we have Dr. Israel Salmon from University College London talking on Maimonides' use of historiography in his legal code. Israel Salmon is a fellow at the Hebrew and Jewish Studies Department at the University College London and an expert on medieval Jewish philosophy and manuscripts.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Nice to be here. Nice to be back. Just want to make sure everyone has a handout.
Not yours.
No. Okay. It's a good thing I asked. There's a pile of them here. So we'll wait. And what I'm going to speak about follows very much directly from what Dr. Lowenthal was speaking about. In fact, I have the passage from the laws on foreign worship or strange worship of Avodah Zarah. I have that chapter in full. Okay, so before we dig into the texts, which I want to do in the spirit of a day of Iyun, a day of looking into things carefully, I want to first put a few issues out on the table. There is a fellow named Avicenna, Ibn Sina, a great Muslim philosopher who lived in the 10th and 11th century. And he wrote a book, sort of an autobiographical book called Chai Ibn Yaktsan, which means the living one in Arabic, the son of the wakeful one. And the argument about that he puts forth in that book, and later on, a later Islamic philosopher rewrote or made his own version of that work. But the basic argument is the question that he starts with, and his reflecting on his own experience, on his own life, and the basic argument that Avicenna puts forth is that a human being, unaided, just by using intellect, is able to arrive at the understanding that there must be some ultimate being, an ultimate reality that sustains all existence. And that ultimate being must be of a different category, of a different sort of being. Basically, something that we call God. And he has various other things. And he said that this is something that a person with a good intellect is able to work out independently, without any tradition, without anyone telling it to him, without any teacher. And that's the argument there. Now, Maimonides has a very similar discussion where he actually draws on biblical texts and midrashic texts, ancient Jewish texts, where that's basically the story that's told about Abraham. That Abraham, and we'll read the passage inside, I think, so that Abraham was immersed amongst idolaters. No one knew God. Everyone had forgotten about God except for a few lone individuals who had the tradition that was passed down to them. But basically, by and large, the entire world had forgotten about God. And Abraham, by contemplation, discovered God through his own efforts. So that's, in Judaism, there is this. And he tells this whole story in his legal code. He tells it at a relative length. So the question is, why does Maimonides tell these sort of historiographical narratives, and several others? He tells another one in the beginning of the laws of Hanukkah. He gives a little background of the what the story is, a little bit more than necessary. He doesn't just, and we'll look at that too. And finally, in the laws where he deals with the messianic king, he also gives a little historiography of what it's going to be like after the Messiah comes. And you wonder why in his legal work does he have to put these little stories, this historiography, describing this. These are seemingly not actually laws. They're not legally relevant. So, it's very nice and it's very important to understand this about Abraham, but from the point of view of a legal code, who cares? What's the difference what Abraham did or didn't do? We just want to know what the laws are about Avodah Zarah, which means strange or foreign worship, worship of foreign anything, worship of anything, than the ultimate, the true, the real God. So who cares what Abraham went through from the legal point of view? And I want to, I hope to develop the idea that Maimonides is interested in legislating not only actions, but also knowledge. That in addition, and we saw that already in Dr. Lowenthal's presentation, in addition to knowing what just tell me what to do, what am I supposed to do, how do I do it, he's also telling you what do I have to know. Maimonides, it's very fundamental to Maimonides that people should know what they have to know. They should know correct views about certain fundamental things. Without that, the whole issue of what I'm supposed to do is irrelevant, almost irrelevant. It doesn't really, that's stage two. Stage one is getting reality straight, and stage two is, okay, following from there, what are the actions that are required of me? So, why is this important? Why are, this gets into another issue, which is governance, or the polity, a polis, a governed body, a city or a state. Now, this also becomes very important to Maimonides. We'll see that a polis should be founded. This is in medieval Islamic and Jewish political theory. A polis, a governed community, should be founded on right principles. And those right principles, what is going to bring the best good to the people, happiness to the people? Well, that will be, if they're a good foundation, truth. If they're led towards truth and reality, then that's really the whole purpose of governing people, to try to lead them towards reality or truth or goodness. Goodness, in other words, that which follows from reality. So, this becomes, so in order to do that, it's not enough to tell people what they have to do. You first have to get people to understand and to know and to acknowledge, to recognize what is reality. And then you can move them along from there. So, correct knowledge is very important. Now, most people are not able to attain correct knowledge, like Chai ibn Yaqzan, like Avicenna, Abraham. Most people don't have powerful enough intellects to do that. So, why does he tell the story about Abraham, the origins of worship, of wrong worship, worship of anything other than God? So, read through that, and what is he trying to establish? And how does that lead then into that? How does that lead into governance, and what does that have to do with religion? So let us begin. And I'll start off reading that maybe other people can. During the times of Enosh, mankind made a great mistake, and the wise men of that generation gave thoughtless counsel. Enosh himself was one of those who erred. What was the mistake? Their mistake was as follows. They said God created stars and spheres with which to control the world. He placed them on high and treated them with honor, making them servants who minister before him. So God is giving a very great position to the stars here, to the planets. Accordingly, it is fitting to praise and glorify them and to treat them with honor. They perceive this to be the will of God. What does God want? God wants respect to be given to those whom he respects. This is the will of God. Blessed be he that they magnify and honor those whom he magnified and honored. Just as a king desires that the servants who stand before him be honored. Indeed, doing so is an expression of honor to the king. So this is mistake number one. After conceiving this notion, they began to construct temples to the stars and offer sacrifices to them. They would praise and glorify them with words and prostrate themselves before them, because by doing so, they would, according to their false conception, be fulfilling the will of God. This was the essence of the worship of false gods, and this was the rationale of those who worshiped them. They would not say that there is no other God except for this star. This message was conveyed by Jeremiah, who declared, "Who will not fear you, King of the nations? For to you it is fitting. Among all the wise men of the nations and all their kingdoms, there is none like you." That means all the wise men, even those who are worshiping stars, if they're wise, they recognize that there's this ultimate being, this ultimate God. They're not by worshipping stars or other things, they're not rejecting God. They have one foolish and senseless notion, however. They conceive of their empty teachings, those of wood. That means that all know that you are alone, God. Their foolish error consists of conceiving of this emptiness as your will. They think that God wants them to do this foolishness to give credence to his tools, to his handiwork, as if they had importance in and of themselves. So that's mistake number one that Maimonides is setting out. And this is all chapter one of the laws of Avodah Zarah, which means foreign worship, the prohibition of worshiping anything other than God. Chapter two will actually get into the details of what exactly is constitutes worship, and what one is allowed to do, what one is not allowed to do, what forms of worship. But here he's just telling the story. He's setting the stage. What the mistake is before he legislates actions. As I said, he's first legislating ideas, knowledge, correct views. So first of all, we have this idea number one that. And just to jump ahead, someone can say, if we'd have left chapter one out and just started with chapter two, what one is allowed to do, what one is not allowed to do in terms of bowing down to other things or these other that sort of thing. So one a person could make the mistake and say, yes, there really is power in these things. There are other powers out there. But for some reason, God told us not to worship any of them, just to worship God alone. And that would be a fundamental undermining of the whole program of Judaism, the whole program of religion, of which is really supposed to lead people to truth. But if they don't have the truth, if you tell them, do this, don't do that, but they don't know why they shouldn't do that, or why they should do this, then they're not really properly going to lead them to truth, or, in other words, happiness as a derivative of having attained truth. So he has to tell them, number one, this is a mistake, this is a problem, to think that number one, all these other stars and things like that, these are just the ministers of God, these are just tools of God. Number two, as such, they don't deserve any worship. They're there just as tools. Number two, this can lead to a further problem. When people recognize God, but mistakenly, innocently think that their worship of God should get them to also worship God's tools or ministers, we get to the problem number two. After many years passed, there arose people, false prophets, who told their nations that God had commanded them to say, serve this star, or all the stars, sacrifice to it, offer libations to it, build a temple for it, and make an image of it, so that all people, including the women, the children, and the common people, could bow to it. So we have a further devolution, further moving away. So now they're actually saying that the stars, that God tells them to serve. Not only it, people realize, people feel, maybe we should do something to respect God's ministers, but they're saying God said to do it. He would inform them, this false prophet, of a form that he had conceived, and tell them that this is the image of the particular star, claiming that this was revealed to him in a prophetic vision. In this manner, the people began to make images in temples under trees and on top of mountains and hills. People would gather together and bow down to them, and the false prophets would say, this image is the source of benefit or harm. It is appropriate to serve it and fear it. Their priests would tell them, the service will enable you to multiply and be successful. Do this and this, or do not do this or this. Subsequently, other deceivers arose and declared that a specific star, sphere, or angel had spoken to them. So it's no longer God communicating. God sort of is pushed to the back burner somewhere. The stars themselves are speaking. Serve me in this manner. He would then relate the mode of service, telling them, do this, do not do this. Okay. Thus, these practices spread throughout the world. People would serve images with strange practices, one more distorted than the other, offer sacrifices to them, and bow down to them. As the years passed, God's glorious and awesome name was forgotten by the entire population. So this is a big problem. Eventually, God is completely forgotten, It was no longer part of their speech or thought, and they no longer knew him. Thus all the common people, the women and the children, would know only the image of wood and stone, and the temples of stone to which they were trained from their childhood to bow down and serve, and in whose name they swore. How about the intelligent people, the more learned people, the people who are educated, the wise men? Next paragraph. The wise men among them, they knew that there's something beyond the physical temple or the physical image. They would think that there is no God other than the stars and the spheres, for whose sake and in resemblance of which they had made these images. So the wise knew that there is something beyond the physical representation, the earthly representation. They knew that there's something up in the sky, a star or something, or a sphere. But the eternal rock was not recognized or known by anyone in the world, with the exception of a few individuals, for example, Hanoch, Methuselah, Noah, Shem, and Aver. The world continued in this fashion until the pillar of the world, the patriarch Abraham, was born. So these people, Shem, Aver, etc., had a tradition. It was passed down to them. They had a tradition that there's some ultimate reality or being, however they conceived of it, I don't know, is called God, or the one God. But what about Abraham? So stage two was a mistake. Let's go back to stage one. Stage one was a mistake that wise men thought that they should give respect to God's tools, and they should worship God's tools. Mistake number two was that eventually they forgot about God, and they thought that the tools themselves were God's, and God was totally lost. So Maimonides wants us to understand this, that the prohibition of idolatry, and he'll say that in a very brief comment in chapter two, it's not the prohibition of idolatry, or so-called idolatry, or false worship, or worshiping the wrong things, is not simply not to do certain actions. More fundamentally, it's not to have a wrong worldview. It's to get reality straight. And therefore, he's going through this whole introduction of how people got reality wrong, how they messed it up. And now we understand where Abraham comes into the picture. Abraham, after this mighty man was weaned, he began to explore and think. Though he was a child, he began to think incessantly throughout the day and night, wondering, how is it possible for the spirit to constantly be in a state of conduct without anyone conducting it? Obviously, there must be someone conducting it. Who is causing it to revolve? For surely it does not cause itself to revolve. He had no teacher, nor was there anyone to inform him. Remember Avicenna and Chai ibn Yaqzan, and now Abraham, long time before Avicenna. The Jewish tradition has the same story with Abraham. Rather, he was mired in Ur of the Chaldees among foolish idolaters. His father, mother, and all the people around him were idol worshippers, and he would worship with them. However, his heart was exploring and gaining understanding. Ultimately, he appreciated the way of truth and understood the path of righteousness through his accurate comprehension. So he had a good mind. He was able to break through all the mire. He realized that there was one God who controlled the sphere, that he created everything, that there is no other God among all the other entities. He knew that the entire world was making a mistake. What caused him to err was their service of the stars and images, which made them lose awareness of the truth. This becomes a very big theme in Maimonides, that that if people go around serving these stars and images, eventually will lead, because people are not that intelligent, to forgetting about really what's behind, you know, how it started, and they'll just end up making gods out of those images and forget about the real God. Abraham was 40 years old when he became aware of his Creator. When he recognized and knew him, he began to formulate replies to the inhabitants of Ur, the Chaldees, and debate with them, telling them that they were not following a proper path. Okay, we've seen people like that on street corners and things like that. Okay, we think that they're a little crazy, but they didn't like Abraham. He broke the idols. Imagine that. Not only was he telling them they're wrong, but he realizes that the worship of idols is distracting them and not enabling them to see what the truth. So he goes and he smashes the idols and began to teach people that it is fitting to serve only the God of the world. Only the God of the world. To him, it is fitting to bow down, sacrifice, and offer libations, so that the people of future generations would recognize him. Interesting between the lines here, the whole point of worshiping seems to be not worship, not because God needs the worship, but that's a way that the common people will sort of recognize and be aware of God. Just to reread that line, to him it is fitting to bow down, sacrifice, and offer libations. Why? So that the people of future generations would recognize him. So all these libations and sacrifices are so people will have a God awareness. They need something.
Educational tools, you might say.
Yeah, they need something to do. Otherwise, if it's totally abstract, they won't. Exactly. Conversely, it is fitting to destroy and break all the images, lest all the people err by means of them. That will be the distraction remains, like those people who thought that there are no other gods besides these images. Well, people didn't like him very much. You can imagine in Ur of the Chaldees, and the powers that be certainly didn't like him very much. He was undermining their whole society. When he overcame them through the strength of his arguments, the king desired to kill him. He was saved through a miracle and left for Haran. There he began to call in a loud voice to all people and inform them that there is one God in the entire world and it is proper to serve him. He would go out and call to the people, gathering them in city after city, kingdom after kingdom, until he came to the land of Canaan, proclaiming God's existence the entire time, as it states, and he called there in the name of the Lord, the eternal God. So he's one of these preachers, yes.
Significantly different is it to sacrifice, say, a pigeon or a bird to a god and bow down to a shape? In both sort of instances, you're performing some sort of act in honor of an entity.
Exactly, they're pretty much identical. Yes, I would say there's no substantial difference between them, and whether it's the shape or the whatever it is, and whatever you're doing. Yes, they're pretty much the same.
But the Jews made sacrifices on a daily basis, continually, to their entity.
No, that's you have to get the right entity. Yes, doing anything, sacrificing and doing all these things is a way of being aware of and being subservient to and dedicating yourself to some entity. If you have the wrong entity, you're fundamentally flawed. But if you have the right entity, then it's a healthy thing.
But you could argue that a totem pole or an image of some sort of sculpture could be your path to a real entity.
Oh no, but the thing is that anything finite or anything corporeal certainly cannot is the antithesis of this entity, of the unmoved mover, of the one that doesn't that's infinite, that doesn't have any body, etc. So yes, if you know that it's good to bow down, it's good to offer sacrifices because that focuses you. But if you do it to anything that's going to distract you, that doesn't match up with the entity, then you have a big problem. And that's what he's trying to establish in this first chapter. So before he tells you can do this, you can't do that, he wants to get you to understand, what's behind it, what rests on this. That's you raise another interesting point that I don't want to digress too much from Maimonides' approach. Well, could other things lead you? Could finite or things that are not God lead you to God? Can you go the opposite direction? That's an interesting question. Solomon Ibn Gabirol seems to believe that maybe you can work in that way. But Maimonides does not seem to. He thinks that, as he said several times, it'll pull you away. Whenever you have any finite thing to look at, that'll actually pull you in the other direction. It'll make you forget about the infinite, non-corporeal. So that's Maimonides, I guess.
It like underlines the subtlety of the prohibition of images in Judaism, images of God. That God is by definition that which we cannot see and cannot define as any kind of form. And it said, maybe apocryphally, Aristotle heard about the Jewish people. They worship a God they cannot see. A nation of philosophers.
Yeah. And not even further, Maimonides says not only can we not ascribe any physical features to God? We can't even ascribe any psychological features to God. But he said that's more difficult for people to process. But ultimately, we should not even ascribe psychological features to God. That's also a form of idolatry in a certain way. So he really wants to move us away from any of these correlatives or totems or anything like that.
Like Rachel
and Chanan,
are they psychological attributes?
Yes. And so it's an accommodation, Maimonides says, just like there's an accommodation, says the hand of God, the feet of God, but really God is beyond any of that. So too, Rachel and Chanan, that's also an accommodation, just like feet and hands. Really, God is beyond any of these categories. But as we and really not process, or it's very, very difficult for us to even begin to process anything like that. So we're allowed to some degree to lean on these things, but hopefully we can move away from them, yeah, ultimately. So what did Abraham do? And the difference between these other stories and Abraham is that Abraham becomes a preacher, and he begins teaching people, and he creates a group behind him. He's actually trying to bring this truth to the masses or to the people. When the people would gather around him and ask him about his statements, he would explain them to each one of them according to that individual's understanding until that individual turned to the path of truth. Ultimately, thousands and myriads gathered around him. These are the men or the people of the house of Abraham. He planted in their hearts this great fundamental principle. So he was a teacher, and he actually created a society or a group of people who began to see the things in this way. They themselves began to understand what he was trying to get at. As Dr. Lowenthal said, what was it, a religion of philosophers? A people of philosophers? A nation of philosophers. So that's really what, in Maimonides' account, that's what Abraham was creating. He was creating a nation of philosophers. He spent time with each individual and taught each individual in that person's way until this became planted in their hearts. And he composed texts about it and taught it to Isaac, his son. Isaac also taught it to others. He taught it to Jacob, just skimming through. Jacob taught others and turned the hearts of all those who gathered around him to God. He taught his children, and he selected Levi, appointed him as a leader. He established him as the head of the academy. So this seems to have been the high point of the nation of philosophers. Abraham is teaching truth about God, iconoclast. He's breaking all the icons, whether they're physical icons or psychological icons. And he really built something new here, a nation of people who know true God beyond all descriptions. And it became planted, and it became a people, it became a nation who knew God. So now, in the paragraph that begins with the bracketed word Jacob, we have at the end of the paragraph, until there became a nation within the world which knew God. So we have a God-knowing nation. And that is the importance of what Abraham... However, the question is that sustainable? Can you sustain a God-knowing a nation? Can you sustain a nation of philosophers? And here is where it becomes difficult and problematic. That was a high point. That was nice. They were going on for three generations. There was a high there. However, when the Jews extended their stay in Egypt, however, they learned from the Egyptians' deeds and began false worship, as they did, with the exception of the tribe of Levi, who clung to the commandments of the patriarchs. The tribe of Levi never engaged in false worship. Within a short time, the fundamental principle that Abraham had planted would have been uprooted, and the descendants of Jacob would have returned to the errors of the world and their crookedness. Okay, so what do you do about that? How can you deal with a situation like that? You create a nation of philosophers, and after a few generations, things become normal again. Not everyone's a philosopher. Not everyone is a great mind. Not everyone has a teacher like Abraham. Not everyone has someone who will work with him individually. So we get to the next stage, which is creating a law, creating a system that will be able to get these points through to everyone. Because of God's love for us, and to uphold the oath he made to Abraham, our patriarch, he brought forth Moses, our teacher, the master of all prophets, which is the greatest intellect, in other words, and sent him to redeem the Jews. After Moses, our teacher, prophesied, and God chose Israel as his inheritance, he crowned them with commandments and informed them the path to serve him, teaching them the judgment prescribed for false worship and all those who stray after it. So we became a people with commandments and formulas and legislation. The times of Abraham didn't need the legislation. They had Abraham. They had the teacher. They had someone to show and teach and nurture them and plant the awareness in their minds. But that's not sustainable. So then we have the next stage. Maimonides repeats that. He wants to recapture the generation of Abraham. He wants to recapture the reality of Abraham. Because even though we move to the next stage, which is a stage of actions and legislation, but that has to be based on something so the sustainable relationship to God, which is more oriented to legislation, has to really be based on God. If you don't have God in the outset, then what is all the legislation there for? There's no relationship. So yes, indeed, chapter 2, he goes on to the details of the legislation, but that is not enough. Even from a legal point of view, you have to have a concept of God and why these other things are incorrect before you can get on to the details of the legislation. Otherwise, the whole thing doesn't have a foundation. Now, how do you perpetuate this sort of legislation? And I want to get a little bit into the role of governance here. Now, we have Hanukkah coming up soon. So, in Book 3, which is Maimonides' Book of Seasons, Laws of the Megillah and Hanukkah, Chapter 5, he starts off with a little historiography. In the era of the Second Temple, when the Greek kingdom issued decrees against the Jewish people, attempting to nullify their faith and refusing to allow them to observe the Torah and its commandments, extending their hands against their property and their daughters, and they entered the sanctuary, wrought havoc within, and made the sacraments impure, the Jews suffered great difficulties from them, for they oppressed them greatly, until the God of our ancestors had mercy upon them, delivered them out of their hand, and saved them. The sons of the Haz. So what is it? So he didn't mention a word about the miracle of the oil here. We are familiar with the miracle of oil. What is the greatness of Hanukkah according to Maimonides? The sons of the Hasmoneans, the high priests, overcame these enemies, slew them, and saved the Jews from their hand. The pans of the people didn't let them keep Torah, etc. They appointed a king from the priests. So what is the greatness of Hanukkah? This is the following line. And sovereignty returned to Israel for more than 200 years until the destruction of the Second Temple. That is what Hanukkah is about, according to Maimonides. The main point of Hanukkah is that the people of Israel, the nation of philosophers, or at least the descendants of the nation of the philosophers, although they have legislation of details, also have the underlying principles, that can be perpetuated, that there can be a polis, that there can be a government, that there can be some kind of ruling body that will nurture and enable the continuity of this great program of knowing God and then having legislation to help one fill it out. And I just with this, I want to segue into the last statements of his legal code. Book 14, the Book of Judges, and the last section of Book 14, the Laws of Kings and Their Wars and the Messianic King, the last chapter, chapter 12. Number 4, it is not in order to have dominion over the entire world or to rule over the Gentiles, to be exalted by the nations or to eat, drink, and be merry that the sages and the prophets yearned for the Messianic era. Rather, it is in order to be free, to involve themselves in Torah and wisdom without any pressures or disturbances so that they would merit the world to come as explained in the laws on repentance. So this is a vision of the future. It may have some practical legal implications, but fundamentally it's really sharing a vision of what we're aiming for, what we're trying to attain, sort of framing the way framing our approach to reality, to life. So what is it about? It's about Torah and wisdom, being involved with Torah and wisdom without any disturbances. to make this bond with God. That's really what the core and the essence of the whole thing is about. In that era, number five, there will be neither famine nor war, envy or competition, for good will flow in abundance, and all the delights will be freely available as dust. The occupation of the entire world will be solely to know God. Why is he telling this to us? I think to some degree he's telling it to us because this is how we're supposed to orient ourselves. And in he has a legal code. He has 14 books in his legal code. And this we're supposed to frame our approach to the entire law, to all the details of the law, to the chapter 2, etc. sort of thing, in light of these larger principles. So that yes, it's historiography, it's a story, what it was like, what it's going to be like, but this is the foundation, the fundamental upon which we have to orient the rest of the law in order for the whole program, for the whole project to work. And he finishes off, therefore the people of Israel will be great sages when the Messiah comes, and know the hidden matters, grasping the knowledge of their Creator according to the potential of a human. As it states, the world will be filled with knowledge of God as water covers the sea. Total inundation, total God awareness. And that is really the goal. It's not military conquest. It's not to be over other people. Really, it's the whole goal of this whole legal code that he's putting together is to create a king, to create a government, to be able to set things up in such a way that, as Abraham did, that awareness of God can be brought to everybody, even to those who don't have great intellects, to set up the polis, set up the rule, to set up the government in such a way that we can actually focus on these underlying issues. When we're doing the rest of the laws, the details of the laws, we can do them in this light, in the light of an overwhelming awareness, an overwhelming knowledge of God. So I think that's why he puts these historiographic points into the narrative, because he is trying to bring us, he's trying to frame our whole approach, he's trying to actually accomplish it. He's trying to give us not only the details of the laws, but the bigger picture, that it's really about correct awareness of God and creating a system that will enable correct awareness of God, and creating governance that will be able to convey correct awareness of God even to those people who won't be able to discover it on their own. So thank you.
I wonder if you'd like to comment on the way he begins his code. Like you've taken these points in the middle, or like Abraham is near the beginning, and taking this final point. Maybe you'd like to comment on the way he begins the code.
Yeah, although it's not historiography, but those are the passages that you were looking at, which is, people are maybe familiar with the Shulchan Aruch, with the code of Jewish law. The code of Jewish law tells you, Maimonides wrote one of the first codes of Jewish law, but there are some later codes, or maybe one earlier code. They have different approaches, a few earlier codes. So the code of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch that we're familiar with, starts off with what is the first thing that you do when you wake up in the morning? How you get out of bed, how you wash yourself, how you get dressed, and what the procedure of the day should be like. There are earlier codes of Jewish law. Another one starts, for example, going through the order that the commandments occur in the Bible. So let's say the first commandment that occurs in the Bible is to be fruitful and multiply, so first deal with that. Then you go just as they occur, that's another approach. Another, the Mishnah itself is a code of Jewish law. And it starts off, for example, with reading the Shema at night. Why at night? People are up since the morning. So why? Because according to Jewish law, the new day starts at night. And the first mitzvah, the first commandment that we have is to read the Shema at night. So all of these are somewhat pragmatic approaches to Jewish law. Maimonides starts his code of Jewish law by, as he says in his table of contents, first he's going to state the things that people have to know first. For example, the existence and unity of God and the prohibition of idol worship or worshiping anything. So he starts his legal code with theory, with concepts, not just with actions, but really with what the underlying realities are. And as he says in one of his later letters, he says, when I saw that there are some rabbis, gaonim, great leaders of academies, and they considered themselves to be great leaders, but some of them were unsure whether or not God has a body or not, because there are verses that speak about God using anthropomorphisms, God's hand, God's feet. And others were sure that God does have a body because of these verses, and if someone felt otherwise, that person is a heretic. And when he saw that what he's up against, he realized, what's the point of going on to get into the details of how to do the specific laws of cooking on Sabbath and things like that if people don't have the fundamentals straight? So he decided that he has to first spell out the fundamentals. So indeed, although he doesn't have historiography there, actually, but he, this runs through the whole work, that it's all true foundations, true knowledge of God, true awareness of God, and the details of the law are there to uphold that, to enhance that, to make a system of making one aware of that.
Yeah, well, one could say that he's beginning with the words, the foundation of all foundations and the pillar of all wisdoms is to know that there is one God.
Or not even one God, but a first being.
A first being.
Yeah.
which causes everything else to be.
Yeah, yeah.
And he then follows that through with these narratives of Abraham discovering this, and how at the end of the story, everyone is going to know that.
Yeah. Which is the uniqueness of Abraham sharing it and realizing that it's not just about him, but it's something that he should share with them.
Even not just about the Jewish people. So it's. So Abraham's initial project gets fulfilled at the end of the story.
Oh, that's actually a nice envelope way of thinking.
Just a comment. Yeah. It seems you're presenting Maimonides as framing the Jewish people as the people of philosophers. Similar, who said that? Aristotle.
Or at least it's put into Aristotle's
mouth. I heard from Dr. Block.
But would you not say that Maimonides, particularly in the legal code of Mishnah Torah, wants to frame the Jewish people as a people of law? They are legal entity, legal focused, and many philosophers see the Jews as not philosophers but law people, people who, you know, must follow the laws, right, as opposed to other peoples.
Okay, so I would say two things. I would say the truth is they are not a people of philosophers, but they are people framed by philosophy. Because that was a problem. Abraham's greatness could be sustained only for a few generations, but without a law, you can. But what is a law about? Number one, philosophy has a part in the law itself, so it's not philosophy versus law. Philosophy is the foundation of the law, and so philosophy comes first in the law itself. Philosophy comes first, and all the rest of the law is actually the outcome or the follow-up of philosophy. Especially since most people can't do philosophy on their own and just live according to philosophy on their own, so they need legislation. But it has to come from foundations, and the foundations are the philosophical foundations. So, yes?
I'm having difficulty with the Messianic era.
Okay.
If it's a time when no problems, everything is absolutely wonderful, and so on. Would there still be a need for philosophers and philosophy, or the study of wisdom and the study of Torah, and so on? I mean, everything would be perfect. So, you know, with no problems and so on, you've got no need for people worrying about problems and so on.
Correct. I think, but what makes it perfect? If I understand correctly, what makes it perfect is not a miracle that, according to Maimonides, that God reaches from beyond and tampers with people and just makes them different or something like that. From what I understand in Maimonides' view, that we sort of, to a large degree, make the Messianic era happen by following the program that he sets forth in his legal code, but not only personally and individually, but doing it in a way that we have a government and legislation, and there's a Messianic king who's able to recover sort of thing that Abraham was doing. Abraham was living a Messianic reality for that little while, not globally, but at least in his area. So really, the Messianic era, maybe I'm wrong, but to some degree, what Maimonides seems to be saying is the Messianic era is a recapturing of those moments of Abraham. And when people live with that awareness and are inundated with that and inundate themselves with that awareness, that gets rid of all the problems.
I think that's a very beautiful way of putting it, if I might say. And it helps me understand something that I kept wondering about as you were talking about it, the idea that it couldn't be sustained, this Abrahamic vision couldn't be sustained. Well, the reason it couldn't be sustained is because they went into Egypt and they became slaves.
Yeah.
But then I began thinking, in fact, that's the problem of daily life. You know, daily life is one form of Egypt or the other, you know, the problems. But when it comes to the Messianic era, all the problems have been solved, and we've reached again that idyllic situation that you don't have problems, and you can just think about God. In a positive way.
And that's why I stuck that little piece in about Hanukkah and the Hasmonean dynasty. It's the idea of governance and having kings is very fundamental. If people are familiar with Plato and his idea of the philosopher king, that's very parallel to what's going on here. Maimonides sees that there's a great need for the king, for a great leader. He's not into democracy. He's really into the idea that great people must come forth, the great philosophers must come forth and actually step out of their ivory tower and lead the people and create society and laws that will able to concretize these great ideals and bring them down to people who aren't on the level and institutionalize them and create something out of them so that these great ideas can actually filter down. And that's why the whole Hanukkah for him is about they appointed the king from the priests and sovereignty returned to Israel for more than 200 years. So Israel stood for something, stands for something. So, you know, that is a greatness of Hanukkah, I think, from Maimonides' point of view.
If that is the greatness of Hanukkah, why doesn't he say anything about the kings of Israel earlier on? Or does he? That he could have said something about the establishment of Solomon
I think his whole final book of the code is about governance, really.
Right.
So in fact, his whole final section, I think he's leading up to it. I think he's saying that these are the laws, these are the details, the middle 12 books are about the detailed laws, but how can you actually make this happen in reality? You can't be sitting somewhere off on your own and expect this thing to work. You need a system of government, a system of judges, but ultimately you need a Jewish king. A Jewish king who is going to that's his final section.
And the Sanhedrin.
But he mentions earlier. But the final thing is really so in this final book, yes, he discusses the Sanhedrin, but ultimately you need a Jewish king to make this happen. And the ultimate Jewish king is the one who's going to restore the whole thing and make it work.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.